The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Riley, Judge Bradfold, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The matter before the court this morning is A210244, Fairmount Housing and Redevelopment Authority versus Tom Winter.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. Thank you so much for agreeing to reschedule this argument and for your helpful supplemental briefing. The court appreciates your the way you handled this and to accommodate our request. So thank you very much. Our argument will proceed much as it does in our physical courtroom. First, each party will have 15 minutes for their main argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask each of you to introduce yourself at the beginning of your comments because we are recording this and we'll make those audio recordings available on our website. If you have any technical issues, and we're experiencing fewer of them these days than we did at the beginning of the pandemic, but if you do, let us know and we'll stop the argument and help with those because we really do want to hear fully from you. You'll notice that there is a clock in one of the squares on the screen, so watch that and we'll help us all keep track of time. And with that, counsel, for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Peter Hemberger. I'm an attorney with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. I represent Thomas Winter and Jean Marty, appellants in this case against the Fairmount HRA Friendship Village. Thomas Winter and Jean Marty are elderly disabled tenants in public housing. Thomas Winter has been a tenant there since 2006. This case involves primarily a lockbox. To give you a sense for the lay of the land, Friendship Village is composed of a number of different smaller buildings. Each building has roughly four units. There's a lobby area with a door to each of those four units for each of these buildings. In addition to the doors to each of the units, there is a door to a utility room in that lobby. On that utility door, beginning January of 2020, there was a lockbox. And this lockbox, it's similar to what you might see that a realtor would have in showing a home. It hangs on the door, there's a code on it, it pops open, and inside there's some keys. In this case, there was a key for each of the different units within that four-unit building. These were installed, like I said, in January of 2020. By sometime around early October of 2020, the appellants, Mr. Winter and Ms. Marty, discovered that the lockbox was open. It was not secure.
Mr. Hemberger,
yes.
If I may interrupt, and we are aware of the facts of this case, but before we get to kind of the underlying issue, if you could address a couple of questions, at least of mine, maybe the other panels, about whether we can reach that. I mean, when you look at the Article 5, the eviction moratorium phase out, it does declare the executive order null and void, which if you're looking at plain language, that would mean as if it didn't exist, right? If you look at least those words in isolation. And I'm also concerned because I know you rely upon the savings clause, the language of 645.35, the savings clause language, but I'm question whether that applies since the Article 5, the session law, says notwithstanding any other law to the contrary. So could you please address just both the plain language and whether just given that any other law to the contrary, whether we can even reach the savings clause language?
Of course. So first, under the plain language of the eviction moratorium phase out, it becomes effective June 30, the day after the enactment on June 29. So yes, the eviction moratorium EO 2079 does become null and void effective June 30, 2021. All the relevant events in this case occurred prior to June 30. The termination was in November 2020, the eviction was in February 2021, and the rights that my clients accrued under that eviction moratorium pre-existed the nullification of the executive order. And I'd wanted, in looking at the plain language of null and void, the legislature didn't say null and void ab initio from the beginning of time. It was null and void beginning on June 30. And I'd like to point out a case, Fleck v. Spanhouse, 251 Northwest 2nd, 334, Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1977, in which the court looked at a certified question. And in that case, the question was, what effect does the termination of, in this case, the Minnesota Pension Act, have upon a cause of action that was pending at that time? And in that case, it was Minnesota Statute 181B.17. The Minnesota Pension Act specifically said, if a new act comes into place, in this case, the ERISA Act, if it comes into place, this act, the Minnesota Act, is null and void. And in that case, the decision was there is no effect on the pending causes of action. I think it's similar here.
But isn't that case distinguishable because they weren't sure if ERISA was going to pass or not, right? I mean, that was a lot of uncertainty, which is, I think, a different here where here's that the legislature is working with the governor. It's kind of it will end and this new phase out provision will begin. Could you help me with that?
Yeah, I do agree. It's a specific set of facts, and in getting into the weeds of the Minnesota Pension Act and what they knew about ERISA being passed, I agree. The broader point is null and void on its own, I don't think means null and void from the beginning of time. I think what is clear is that as of June 30th, when that law became effective, yes, it's no longer effective law. There were rights that accrued, and I referenced the Ogren case again, which dealt with changes to workers' comp law in the same way. The rights that were accrued at the time were back in early 2021 when the eviction moratorium was in place. I guess apart from those considerations, I would also like to look at...
If I can just follow up, it sounds to me, and you can keep persuading me otherwise, that perhaps this is the phase-out legislation and the impact of the null and void language is ambiguous. It's unclear what it means. It's susceptible to more than one meaning. And if that's true, then what do you think your best argument is for how we should interpret that statute to give effect to the legislature's intent?
Yeah. Well, I would say, yes, it is ambiguous. Again, there wasn't any, the only date we have is that it's null and void as of June 30, 2021. Had the legislature wanted to go back and say it's null and void, again, ab initio, or using some other language to indicate such, they could have, but they didn't. So yes, it's ambiguous. So when we look at the intent of the legislature, I think we can look at the intent of the eviction moratorium itself, of what's trying to be achieved through these eviction moratoria. And what that intent is to protect and to maintain stable housing. In interpreting...
Can we run into a problem there, though? Because that would be the governor's intent, right, in the executive order. So it seems to me we've got to look at the phase-out legislation and consider what, and of course that's where the rub is anyway, because that's where we have the null and void language.
Yeah. It's clear from the intent of the phase-out that there was this timeline put in place, a timeline of phasing out and an allowance for a continuance of additional more and more evictions to go through as time went on. At the time that it initially passed, the protections that were in place were essentially kept the same. The family member exception was removed, but you still could only evict if there was serious endangerment, if there was significant property damage. In many ways, it carried on the same restrictions, at least right out of the gate on June 30th, that existed in the previous eviction moratorium, the governor's moratorium. So to the extent that it really mirrored and dovetailed with the moratorium, it would seem that, yes, the intent of the moratorium is the governor's intent, but it seemed to really continue in practice and in the spirit of the moratorium. Again, because the same restrictions applied for the most part, apart from the family member exception, which went away But things related to serious endangerment, related to significant property damage, related to 504B171, the criminal behavior, which would allow for termination.
Question, if I may, on the null and void, at least from me. Other than the statute addressed in the Fleck versus Spanis case, are you aware of any other time the legislature has declared a law null and void?
No. I mean, I'm sure it's happened. I haven't found any of my research that's worth noting, I guess. So, no. I did want to note also, though, that, you know, even if it's determined that EO 2079 is null and void and therefore has no impact any longer, and it's therefore a moot issue, we still have the other issue here, the second issue in this appeal, and that is that the district court did not conclude that there was a serious or repeated lease violation. This is public housing, after all. And in public housing, we don't use the typical standard. We're not solely concerned whether or not there's a material lease violation, which is what all of the conversation discussion at the district court was around, was whether or not there's a material lease violation, which is the wrong standard. In this case, serious lease violation is required. Now,
Mr. Hamburger, I just want to make sure that I understand your argument if we do reach the merits. And you're not saying, at least as I read your briefs, that the district court erred in making any of its factual findings. You're saying that it erred when it concluded that there was a violation that would warrant eviction. Is that right?
My conclusion is, what I'm arguing is that there was no conclusion that there was a serious lease violation. What the court concluded.
You're not saying that the judge's factual findings were in error.
No.
Thank you.
No. In this case, the court determined that that it was a material lease violation for the appellants to fail to notify their landlord of this issue. The requirement to notify the landlord of issues on the property specifically deals with issues with plumbing, issues with heating, issues with appliances of that type. And that's in paragraph 14 of the lease. Paragraph 14 of the lease provides duties of a tenant. It is notably not in the section of the lease, which is paragraph 18, that defines the types of activities that would be expressly considered serious lease violations. And so, again, there, because of that, then a respondent looks to the language within paragraph 18 and says, well, within paragraph 18, it is a serious lease violation to engage in any activity that threatens others, the health and safety of others. In this case, the only activity that appellants engaged in was telling law enforcement of the problem with this lockbox. Yes, they waited a few weeks in which they had no activity. But if we want to look at actual activity, which is what's the concern in paragraph 18 of the lease, the activity was doing what they were supposed to do. And in the time that they waited, there was no threat to anyone. There was no damage. There was no harm. There was no emergency responders that were impeded, not able to get into the property. Simply wasn't a serious lease violation.
I struggle with your argument on that one because we do have, you're right, the district court found in the conclusions of law 3 that this was a material violation of the lease agreement. But the district court also found that that violation endangered the safety of the residents because it allowed anyone to gain access to the resident apartments at any time. So, district court didn't use the exact language required by federal regulations, but it seems to me the court gets at the same point. So,
I think the issue is though that where the court determined that there was a material lease violation was in a portion of the lease that wasn't defining what is a serious lease violation. In order to be evicted in a public housing lease under the Code of Federal Regulations, there has to be a serious lease violation. And those what is constitutes a serious lease violation is listed in paragraph 18. There's no finding that there was a violation of or any activity under those enumerated options given in paragraph 18. The only one that gets close is the one that's any activity that threatens the health and safety of others. But here again, there was no activity that they undertook other than the activity that they were supposed to undertake, which is notify the landlord. In this case, they did it through the police officers. Again, they waited some time to undertake that activity, true, but their activity was the correct one. Before that, all they had was knowledge. They knew something. And certainly knowing something shouldn't be the basis for an eviction. That just simply knowing something shouldn't be considered a serious lease violation, especially when in the end they did what they were the right thing. They did what they were supposed to do. I think to conclude, again, it's my position, it's the appellant's position that yes, the eviction moratorium still applies because they accrued rights at the time that the moratorium was in effect. The moratorium was made null and void, but at dates after any relevant dates in this appeal. Appellants request that this court reverse the district court's eviction order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Nelson, we'll turn to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Carrie Nelson. I am the attorney for respondent Fairmont Housing and Redevelopment Authority, sometimes referred to as Fairmont HRA, which manages the property known as Friendship Village. Based on the supplemental brief and the arguments here today, appellants appear to be arguing that they have permanently vested or accrued rights based on the temporary peacetime emergency order by the government. What that means is that, in essence, they're asking this court to rewrite their lease contract and existing Minnesota statutes based on a suspension of evictions that was always, and I don't think anybody can dispute this, always intended to be temporary. Effective June 30, 2021, that executive order was nullified, but appellants still seem to be arguing that they have vested rights. I mean, that's the term that they use in their brief. What the phase-out order by the legislature says is that since June 30 of this year, landlords have been able to terminate leases for material lease violations. And since July 14, 2021, essentially, landlords have been able to file eviction actions for material violations of lease, other than certain non-payment of rent cases. And I want to be clear, we're not talking about non-payment of rent, even though that's a breach of lease, that's a separate issue. We're talking about material violations other than non-payment. And on February 21st of this year, the district court found that the acts of Ms. Marty and Mr. Winter constituted both a material breach of lease and serious endangerment of others. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I'm just trying to understand. I believe, speaking for myself, that certainly if this action were dismissed and the landlord went back and started a new eviction proceeding, then, you know, clearly just speaking for myself, I assume that the executive order would not come into play at all. But what I believe we're talking about as being kind of a vested or accrued right is really the right to this appeal, right? You know, do we still have that? Or does this null and void language just eviscerate the right to this appeal, at least on the first issue? And I would also like you to address whether or not you agree with Mr. Kimberger that the second issue, underlying issue, is still before us, even if we adopt your reasoning under the null and void language.
Yes, thank you. The respondent's position is that as of June 30th, the executive order has no operative effect. That means that there are no rights that can any longer be enforced as part of this appeal or as of any appeal with regard to, you know, whether or not a lease violation, a material lease violation is an evictable offense.
And that would that reasoning also apply then to landlords that are have brought appeals from district court orders applying the governor's executive order? I just want to be clear on this.
And I'm struggling to think how a landlord would have brought an appeal based on the executive order, because generally the landlord is not favored under the executive order. The landlords are suspended from bringing eviction actions under the executive order. And that suspension has ended. And it's interesting that the governor used the word suspension. That's what is permitted under the peacetime emergency statute, which is Minnesota statute 12.31. It talks about the governor's orders or the governor's authority to suspend things during the peacetime emergency. It also limits the peacetime emergency to the governor can issue an emergency order for 5 days. The executive council can have that out to 30 days. But as you'll remember, the governor was extending the order every 30 days because that was, you know, his authority. So, you know, to answer your question about landlords, I think that the rights of landlords and residents to enforce the executive order are no longer in existence as of June 30th. And then as to your second question about whether we would still be here absent the executive order, I think that the answer to that, if you look at the, you know, what actually the district court found, I think that the answer to that is no, we probably wouldn't be here. I think that that's a fallback argument. I think that that's an argument that is legally futile because the it exalts, you know, form over substance. Judge Bradfield had asked about, you know, what is a, you know, whether the court in actuality did find that there was a serious or repeated violation of a material term of the lease. And if you look at paragraph 18 of the lease that Mr. Hemberger referred to, it says that serious or repeated violation, such as, but not limited to, so that's not the only list of items that can be serious violations, but it does say that, you know, activity that violates or that endangers others is a serious violation. And Mr. Hemberger argued that just knowing about the lockbox was not a violation. And the issue wasn't that they knew about it. The issue is that they knowingly concealed this dangerous condition for about a month. And that's undisputed.
So what about Mr. Hemberger's argument that the duty to maintain the lockbox under the lease falls to your client?
Well, the lockbox was installed in January. And what happened was whoever opened it made it appear as though it was closed. So this was a dangerous condition that was not apparent to the landlord. And of course, we were also in the middle of a pandemic where landlords were supposed to, you know, people were sheltering in place, landlords were supposed to minimize contact with residents. And Ms. Didi, the manager of the property said, you know, the lockbox looked like it was locked. So from a visual inspection, and Mr. Winter admitted this, the lockbox appeared to be locked, but it wasn't. And that's not just a hypothetical concern, because even just a month or so ago, they had a previous resident of the property who tried to break into various units there. Now, had that previous resident had access to master keys to the apartments, you know, I think it's pretty clear that that's an endangerment type of situation. That's exactly what the lease provisions are intended to address.
So if I could take us back to kind of the null and void issue. I understand you're saying this is kind of, this language is plain. It means null and void. It's as if it never existed. But, and this harkens back to one of Judge Bradfall's questions earlier, isn't the fact that this language, it's null and void, kind of followed right after by talking about a phase out? If it's a phase out of a moratorium, how can you say that it's as if the moratorium never existed when the language of the law itself talks about phasing it out? Doesn't that at least, those inconsistencies at least make it the statutory language ambiguous, where we really then have to look at legislative history?
Sure. And assuming that that language is considered to be ambiguous, the court looks at the intent. And certainly the intent of the moratorium was to protect people during the peacetime emergency. And that was replaced by the moratorium phase out. The peacetime emergency actually ended on July 1st. And so even if you look at the intent of the moratorium and the intent of the phase out, they are similar, but the phase out statute replaced the moratorium with the specific terms of the phase out. If you argue that the residents still have accrued rights under the executive order, what you're doing is creating two classes of tenants. You have the tenants who violated their leases during the executive order, who have these apparently accrued rights to not be evicted, versus tenants who violate their leases materially after the executive order, after June 30th. And so you're really creating two different leases and two different sets of conditions. And I think that runs into constitutional issues as well.
Aren't there constitutional issues regarding due process if someone has rights and then they're taken away? I mean, that is, I think those underlying considerations is what is why the 645.35 kind of refers to kind of a savings clause, at least saving some of those kind of in-process procedures. That's at least my reading of the case law, but please enlighten me.
Well, I think that the due process issue comes down to notice. And where you have due process issues is where the rights are taken away without notice. And so where you have notice from the beginning that these rights are going to be, if you want to characterize them as rights, really what it is a suspension of the landlord's rights rather than creation of a new right for tenants. But if you're saying that, you know, that these rights accrued, everyone should have been on notice from day one of the moratorium that this moratorium was going to end. These rights were going to go away. That you know, the language of the executive order itself says the ability of property owners or other persons entitled to recover residential premises to an eviction action is suspended, other than of course the exceptions, and that was during the peacetime emergency. So I think that the due process issue here is that everyone was on notice that this moratorium would end at some point, that this peacetime emergency would end at some point, and at that time, the protections of the moratorium would terminate.
Could you also address the question that I asked Mr. Hinberger? Are you aware, outside of the statute addressed in the Fleck versus Spanis case, of any other law that the legislature has declared null and void?
I'm not. And we did look. And, you know, I think obviously what we're dealing with here is a very specific set of circumstances surrounding a peacetime emergency where everybody was doing the best they could in the moment. And, you know, decisions were sort of being made on the fly because that's how it works in an emergency. And so, you know, this is a specific circumstance and needs to be treated as such when the court's looking at, you know, how to interpret what, you know, how much of the eviction moratorium, if any, still exists or whether there's any rights existing under it. And again, I do want to just reiterate that, you know, this is not a minor lease violation. The district court agreed that it wasn't a minor lease violation, and it was a very real endangerment for over the course of a month. And so the, you know, our position is that the district court got it right, and there just isn't anything else for this court to consider as far as the eviction moratorium. And so even looking at, you know, what sort of remains after that, those arguments essentially fail as a matter of law, and there's nothing else for the court to consider regarding those as well.
If you've concluded, Ms. Nelson?
Yes, unless the court has other questions, that's my bit.
Any questions from the panel? Thank you. Counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you. Just want to touch on 3 points. First, with regard to the due process issue, this is something that I covered in the supplemental memo. I do think there's a concern that if this appeal is considered moot, that the appellant's ability to raise issues under 504B and under federal law and the requirements for an eviction termination under public housing, that those rights to be heard be lost. Counsel for respondent referred to due process essentially being a notice issue. The other half of that coin is notice and the right to be heard. That's due process, notice and the right to be heard. And if this issue is dismissed, their right to be heard on their disagreement about not just the EO 2079 issue, but on the issue of whether or not there was actually a serious lease violation, that also goes away. So I think it's important that this that be understood. And that's something, again, that is referenced in the brief and is talked about in the AT&T case around kind of the reasoning for the 645.35 and that the nature of that savings statute. The second issue has to do with something respondent referred to as this concern for kind of a perpetual right being created for two classes of tenants, where if we look at these rights created under the EO 2079 as being kind of vested rights, there's this concern, well, there's perpetual rights. No, and the reason for that is, I mean, that's what the Ogren case, I think, gets at. The Ogren case talks about the rights that existed at the time, you know, what we look at in terms of when the rights accrued, and then what statute we look at the time that those rights are asserted, to kind of limit that, I think. And here we see both when they were accrued in November, February of 2020 and 2021, and then also when they were asserted at that at the district court level, EO 2079 was the applicable law. Now, if somebody were to try to assert a defense under EO 2079 at this point at the district court level, of course, that wouldn't be a viable option. But that isn't when they were asserted. They were asserted in February of 2021, when it was very much the law of the land. Third, on the issue of what is a serious lease violation, respondent's attorney references, well, look, this isn't an exclusive list. It refers to, you know, these things are examples. And apart from that, it could be other lease violations that could be considered serious lease violations. And I would say, to the extent we're looking outside of that enumerated list in paragraph 18 of the lease, I do think then we need to start to consider, well, what does serious mean? How is serious lease violation, how is that different from a material lease violation? And there, I do think that there is some case law in the Wilhite case that I mentioned in my brief that it's informative It is on a different type of federally subsidized housing, but it's in the same, certainly the same ballpark. And in that case law, serious is talked about as different from material. Serious includes some kind of financial loss or economic burden placed upon the landlord. In addition, we can look at the moratorium phase out itself. In the moratorium phase out at the beginning on day one, on June 30th, again, serious endangerment, again, that word serious was there. And those evictions, those terminations happened immediately. Whereas where there was only a material lease violation, landlords had to wait a couple of weeks. That didn't kick in until I think July 14th. So even there, we see the legislature making a distinction between serious. If it's serious, you can move ahead right now. But if it's material, it's slightly less. You got to wait a little bit. And clearly, that's what we see from that timeline. It's kind of like the more serious stuff goes first, and then as time goes on, more and more is allowed to come through the door in terms of eviction. So that's what I wanted to respond to. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer, at least.
Any other questions from the panel? Well, we thank you both very much for your helpful argument and briefing. The court will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days. And this ends our oral arguments for the morning.
Thank you.